Universität Hamburg.
With the introduction of its core themes, images and narrative strategies into the mainstream in recent decades, science fiction in its traditional sense appears to have lost its competitive edge and its innovative potential. Frederick Jameson recently described this trend as a rapprochement between high and low culture and the blurring of distinctive generic characteristics that was in his 2005 Archaeologies of the Future. However, the genre's utopian, subversive and critical elements have survived in the field of alternate history fictions and have even experienced a comeback in recent years. Alternate histories are, of course, well established in the Anglo-American context. Philip Dick's Man in the High Castle, Keith Roberts' Pavan, Richard Harris' Fatherland, Kim Stanley Robinson's Years of Rice and Salt, the list goes on. But less so in German literature, and this is where, in my paper, I want to redress the balance. I want to explore three recent examples from German literature. Christian Kracht's Ich werde hier sein im Sonnenschein und im Schatten from 2008, Wolfgang Jeschke's Das Cusanusspiel from 2005, and Rob Alef's Das magische Jahr from 2008. My objective is to show how a classic device of fantastic literature is employed in the mainstream to introduce utopian or dystopian elements and subvert traditional reading habits. Christian Kracht is well known for his novels Faserland and 1979. Ich werde hier sein im Sonnenschein und im Schatten, I'll be here in sunshine and in Shadow. The third novel of this Swiss writer and globetrotter starts with a simple yet fundamental retrospective change to world history. In this novel, Lenin never left Switzerland in 1917 but stayed and, together with Kropotkin and Bakunin, established a Swiss Soviet Republic. In the year 2013, this state has been engaged in almost 100 years of war with fascist Germany and Britain. Russia has been contaminated by an unspecified catastrophe, and America is engaged in a bitter civil war. Warfare hasn't advanced much beyond World War I airships, bombs, and gas, but is nevertheless conducted with fanatic efficiency. To hold its own, the Swiss Soviet Republic has resorted to colonizing the greater parts of Africa, spreading its unique blend of efficiency and communist ideology, and recruiting its cannon fodder and increasingly its officers for this forever war. The unnamed narrator is one such black stranger in a strange land, a political commissar charged by the Swiss Supreme Soviet with the capture of one Oberst Brzezinski, an officer gone rogue. The commissar travels to the recently recaptured Neu-Bern, which appears stuck in a permanent winter, and sets off on horseback to find Brzezinski. On the way, he encounters a war-torn, desolate country full of minefields and desperate survivors. And eventually, he reaches the gigantic alpine Riduy, a vast underground shelter below the Alps that has proven impenetrable for the German bombs, but in reality is little more than a warren of damp tunnels. Here the commissar encounters the colonel, who holds a position of mysterious influence, much as Mr. Kurtz in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, or Colonel Kurtz in Francis Coppola's Apocalypse Now. Brzezinski manages to talk the commissar out of returning him to trial and execution and opens his eyes to the real situation, namely that everyone is exploited to continue a pointless war that cannot be won. The commissar Brzezinski eventually goes mad, blinds himself, and dies miserably, and the commissar escapes a coordinated attack on the Riduy by German airships and slowly makes his way back to his native Malawi, shedding on the way the ideological indoctrination of his youth. As the remnants of Swiss colonial power disappear under the returning jungle, the ex-commissar disappears into the African vastness. And that's just a brief plot. Literary critics in Germany had a difficult time with Kracht's novel. It wasn't until Dietmar Dart's review that the German feuilleton realized that Christian Kracht had once again cocked a snook at the literary establishment. Dart correctly identifies the blind spot Germany's professional critics have when it comes to the popular, and that Kracht's in sich ruhender Größenwahn, his calm megalomania, caused them to ignore the most obvious question that needed to be asked, namely, why does Kracht need the victory of Bolshevism in Switzerland? Duff supplies the answer himself: communism kept the capitalists honest. Following the collapse of communism, the world has turned into a madhouse, a fact that both fascinates and appalls a writer with a global outlook. Ich werde hier sein im Sonnenschein und im Schatten has disturbing qualities. It gets uneasily close to our own seemingly endless wars and pursuits of mad individuals hidden in deep caves under mountains. It uses estrangement to remind us of the power of the failed socialist dream, but also of the horror of its consequences. Is there any possibility of redemption for imperialists? Does neutrality keep your conscience clear? Kracht seems to say that even our best intentions and the proverbial Swiss perfectionism cannot ward off the corroding effects of totalitarianism. If Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness was a criticism of the ideology of imperialism, Christian Kracht's book can be read as a criticism of the imperialist nature of ideology and an imaginative engagement with the psychology of the colonized mind. Kracht does not deny his commissar dignity and culture, but in the end, these European attributes are discarded. The dream of a world without racism is as ephemeral as the snow in Africa. In spite of the brooding atmosphere, the book has a utopian edge. Kracht uses the means of estrangement inherent in alternate histories to attain the freedom that allows him to comment on questions of post-colonial mentality, the danger of ideological control inherent in utopian euphoria, and the deep-seated mindset of superiority, the root cause of inequality and war that is still prevalent in our society. By referencing Conrad and Coppola, he clearly links his work with two instances of cultural critique, be it of the original hubris of Western colonialism or of American imperialism. His fiction, however, targets the much more complex question of what happens when the colonizers are also the colonized, a reflection on our modern world of migration, and the question to what extent identity can be maintained and or created in such a world. Through the protagonist's journey from ice to heat, from seclusion to open spaces, from endless war to peace, Kracht constructs a utopian space where the gestus of people who claim to know what is good for the rest is questioned, while it retains the sense of solidarity and empathy that neoconservatives and neoliberals lack. I would argue that we cannot fully understand this book until we place it in the context of the wider tradition of alternate histories. Kracht hides a reference to Philip Dick's classic, The Man in the High Castle, in his text. Science fiction readers will appreciate this brief acknowledgement. Other readers will miss it or dismiss it. Small wonder, then, that in spite of all the publicity that the book has garnered, Kracht has so far only picked up one prize for this novel, the Fantastic Preis der Stadt Wetzlar in 2009. Wolfgang Jeschke's novel Das Cusanus-Spiel, The Cusanus Game, from 2005, is a sophisticated exploration of the outer limits of fantastic literature, mixing alternate history, time travel, and parallel world narratives, and combining the very latest scientific theories on the nature of time and space with medieval religious philosophy. Like Kracht, he is well aware of the alternate history tradition. He acknowledges Jack Finney's Time and Again, Arkady and Boris Strugatsky's Hard to Be a God, and Karl Amery's Das Königsprojekt specifically. In 2052, climate change has become harsh reality. Southern Europe is covered by sand blown across the Mediterranean, and the migrating masses from North Africa are forcibly kept away from fortress Europe. Neo-Nazis hunt those who slip through the net. Due to global warming, the sea levels are rising. While huge dams have been built along the coastlines of Europe, large areas of the poor countries of Asia are flooded, leading to even more migration. The European Union has disintegrated following the explosion of a French nuclear reactor in 2028. Large parts of Central Europe have been radioactively contaminated and are now virtually uninhabitable. As a result of the radiation, species extinction has been accelerated by the rapid spread of genetically mutated plants. In this bleak future, the young Italian botanist Domenica Ligrina finds a job at the Istituto Pontificale della Rinascita della Creazione di Dio, a scientific department of the Vatican, which has been moved to relative safety in Salzburg. Scientists at this mysterious institute have developed a process that allows them to send agents into the past to collect genetically intact plants, which will be used to repair the damage in the present. After her initial training in Venice, she travels through the contaminated Germany. And she is then sent to the year 1451, where she collects plants, seeds, but is arrested in Cologne. She's accused of heresy, dealing with the devil, and eventually tried as a witch. In her desperation, Domenica writes a series of letters from her prison cell to the German Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, of whom she knows that he traveled via Cologne in 1451. This constitutes an illegal intervention in history, and a series of breaks in the timeline occur, which in turn opens a series of parallel worlds. In the first timeline, Cusanus rides on, and Domenica is burned in public. In the second timeline, Cusanus returns to Cologne to talk to her. She's released and can return to her own time. In a third variant, the letters have disappeared, but Cusanus hears a rough summary and decides to ask the Archbishop of Cologne for a postponement. In each case, Cusanus learns something about the future, as in her letters, Domenica has revealed details of his cosmological and scientific work that at this point in time exists only in his head. As a result of these messages from the future, an alternate course of history is created, which the omniscient narrator describes as the Cusanian acceleration. This history, or alternate history, accelerated history of the last 500 years is meticulously described then, beginning with a letter from Cusanus to Pope Nicholas V, in which he proposes the creation of a scientific academy at the Holy See, which would deal specifically with unusual natural phenomena and the revival of the humanistic heritage. In this science-friendly atmosphere, a new type of engine is invented as early as 1478. This revolutionizes trade and transport. And the West then secures its access to the oil wells in the Middle East. And because of the intense use of fossil fuel, sea levels begin to rise already in 1825. Earth's first airship crosses the Atlantic mid-18th century. 1908, a radiation sickness is discovered near nuclear power plants. Winston Churchill is celebrated in 1918 as a unifier of Europe. And in 23, Hitler and Ludendorff are killed when their coup attempt fails. In the first half of the 20th century, a further development of the embankments against the rising sea levels is agreed upon, and in 1945, President Charles de Gaulle declares that Europe must become an impregnable fortress. So it is at this point that the reader begins to realize that Domenica's reality, which one has until then assumed to be a straightforward extrapolation of our own reality into the future, is in fact one of the parallel worlds that have arisen because of her intervention. In fact, there are more and more clues in the text that the various timelines have intertwined, that history itself has become porous. Despite all this, Domenica is allowed a second trip into the past, this time with the objective to prevent the death of her father, who was killed in 2039 in a terrorist attack. Back in 2039, she meets herself as a young girl, thus causing a time paradox which completely throws her out of the reality of her own time. As the attempt to save her father has several possible outcomes, the timelines turn into an inextricable knot. The scientists in Amsterdam take this quite calmly. According to their theories, time has an organic nature. Like a self-optimizing computer program, it will brush out timelines that cannot stabilize themselves. Jeschke references, of course, Stephen Hawking's theory of time, Hugh Everett's superstring theory, and quantum cosmology in this. He adds to this mix his own fantastic variant, namely the solitons. These waves run from the beginning to the end of time, then change their direction and move back towards the past. Time travelers can surf these waves without having to understand the process. Strictly speaking, we are in the role of dogs that have learned to take the subway. This surfing in time is represented quite poetically in the novel, and one would hope for a translation into English at some time. Like H.G. Wells in The Time Machine, the author romanticizes the end of time and the process of time travel itself, bringing categories such as wonder and grandeur into the mix. Sober scientists rarely allow for these contemplative moments, of course, but in science fiction, they have been fundamental since its beginning. For the reader, this contradiction, on the one hand, the seemingly plausible scientific explanation of unprecedented events, on the other hand, Jeschke's irrepressible storytelling skill, forms part of the aesthetic experience, one that Kurt Laßwitz, the father of German science fiction, described in 1895 in his essay Über Zukunftsträume as the necessary and adequate stance of the face of the rapid development of modern science. With Das Cusanus-Spiel, Jeschke has introduced new aspects into the venerable tradition of alternate history fictions. There's the confrontation of two imaginary worlds, on the one hand the transition from Middle Ages to the Renaissance, where Cusanus, way ahead of his time, developed his theory of the coexistence of the real and the possible, so-called docta ignorantia. On the other hand, we have the world at the middle of the 21st century where human invention and the creation can be repaired by traveling back to this supposedly dark time. In a further step, Jeschke integrates this juxtaposition of the real and the possible into the plot. For example, the description of the consequences of the nuclear accident which has turned the survivor into genetic cripples. I want to briefly talk about one more novel along this line, namely a detective novel, Das magische Jahr, by Rob Alev. He provides a satirical view of what might have happened had the West German student movement been successful in 1967-1968. Those of you not familiar with the German student movement 1968, it is a major myth. It is something that exercises Germans a lot still to this day. So in this alternate history, the revolution has happened, but the irony is that nothing much has happened, nothing much has changed. People continue to phone into radio stations to request a dedication to their grandparents, only now they ask for the songs of the revolution. Everybody has a job, but only because the underqualified are employed to act as human info booths, reeling off useless information to passers-by. School children are brought into theaters to learn about Marxist dialectics in a Punch and Judy show, learn about the Mehrwert, and visit museums to study the history of the revolution. And of course, like school children in the real world, they are bored by the attempts of their equally bored teachers to convey to them the significance of the historic events that led to the revolution. The peace and quiet of this fictional post-revolutionary Berlin is shattered when the internet dealer Prometheus Braumann is brutally murdered. Braumann, once a key member of the movement and a close associate of the great student leader Richard Dubinsky, very close to Rudi Dutschke, the German student leader, has turned his revolutionary past into a gold mine. He sources and sells historically important memorabilia to keen collectors, for example, Theodor Adorno's hole puncher for 2,000 euros, or Ulrike Meinhof's toothpick, authenticity guaranteed. In this alternate world, things had shifted and everything had changed in 1968. The event that turned the tide was the battle for Tegeler's Fleece, when the students won a major confrontation with the police and public opinion turned in their favor. In reality, the Schlacht am Tegeler Weg was the final convulsion of the German student movement. The other crucial difference to real events is that Dubinsky was shot dead by an assassin. As a consequence, he is revered as a patriotic hero and martyr. Rudi Dutschke was not. He was just hurt. And as a consequence, he is revered as a patriotic hero and martyr. And every year, there's an official victory celebration where the Fleece, nothing more than a seat warmer in a police car belonging to a police sergeant, gets paraded around the streets of Berlin as the birth certificate of our new community. Only when three further former members of the commune are killed does the investigating detective realize that the murderer is looking for a photograph to prevent a long-held secret becoming public, namely that, contrary to official history, Dubinsky had not been in Berlin on the decisive day, but an avid fan had traveled to Hamburg to watch the Beatles play. In the end, it doesn't really matter what happened 40 years ago. Different events may have altered the course of the history, but as Alev points out right at the beginning, rivers will never flow upstream. The old order may have been overthrown, but the world is of the same. All the alternate histories discussed in this paper deal with Schnee von gestern, literally yesterday's snow. This is one of the traces that can be found in the third novel I was talking about. Der Schnee von gestern ist die Lawine von morgen is a slogan profoundly uplifting for readers of a revolutionary leaning and, of course, absolutely banal for everyone else. But this Schnee von gestern, yesterday's snow, in its colloquial meaning just old news, is something that is no longer relevant. I would argue that all these texts are designed to show their readers the effects of ways of thinking that are no longer relevant. Krachts Ich werde hier sein im Sonnenschein und im Schatten targets the utopian dream of socialism that forever desires to do good but always ends in totalitarianism. Wolfgang Jeschke's Das Kusanenspiel challenges our belief in technological progress that we hope will save us from ecological disasters, even though these disasters were caused by technology in the first place. Ropalais, Lampoons, the smug members of the 68er generation, whose lives have become as square as the generation they rebelled against and who have held onto their myth too long. And yet, in each of these alternate histories, yesterday's snow has the potential to become an avalanche, to cause fundamental change or upset. In some of the texts, there's hope for a concrete utopia, Ernst Bloch's elusive not yet. Krachts Black Commissar breaks his colonial and ideological shackles and returns to a life that is both self-determined and in line with his traditions. Jeschke's doomed heroine, on the other hand, may find refuge at the end of time, but no amount of tinkering with the timelines can fundamentally alter the course of history, something that Kim Stanley Robinson recently discussed in an interview at length. To stretch the metaphor somewhat, it is more a question of deciding whether to wait for the avalanche to come down on its own or to set it off in a controlled explosion. Aleph's satire is ambiguous about a positive outcome. It is entirely plausible that even the most successful revolution will run out of steam. At the same time, the text itself serves as a reminder that a different life is possible, perhaps desirable. My parting shot, all these alternate histories poke irreverent fun at received wisdom and predictability. They are examples of subversive cultural criticism. In their utopian, dystopian, or satirical guise, they radically challenge the status quo, something that science fiction used to excel at. However, none of the texts discussed in this paper was sold under the label of science fiction or fantastic literature. Does that mark a decline of fantastic literature? I would argue that it does not really matter whether alternate histories have successfully made the transition from fringe to mainstream, or whether mainstream literature has absorbed a central device of science fiction. The important thing is that the form is alive and well, demonstrating its innovative potential and continuing relevance. Thank you.